Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station. Hello, and welcome to Dig This, Trump Watch, with host Professor Parker Pollack. Hello, Professor Pollack.
Hi, Pamela.
Trump Watch airs the first Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. I am Pamela Spodo, and it's just Professor Pollack and myself in the studio today, and we have a lot to talk about. And some of the questions that Professor Pollack may pose, I'm going to tell you a little bit about here. For example, will the real Donald J. Trump please stand up or sit down or take a knee regarding his fears for his problematic performance in leading this country? And what about the views on domestic and foreign policy as well as access to mental health services? And as time allows, we will continue to pursue when it was our nation was great with some historical events that can determine when that was. And I wonder if we will find that time in history. So, Professor Pollack, where would you like to begin today?
Well, Pamela, I thought we'd start with the idea of the kneeling, which the president has also come out with sports figures, which began with Colin Kaepernick with the 49ers, kneeling during the Star-Spangled Banner before the start of the game. And so it really, the president got in on it. Every time, you know, you turn around, you run into commentary about it from my high school friends, from my family members, from the people I exercise with at the gym. It's become quite a topic. And so I spent some time just trying to ponder the National Football League's options here as they try to figure out Colin Kaepernick is a good player. He hasn't been able to get a contract yet this year. Most pundits are suggesting that it's because they're afraid that he won't stand for the national anthem, that he will. Well, when he began doing this last year, he sat on the bench while the rest of his team stood up for the national anthem. And then someone, I suppose a friend, got him aside and mentioned to him that, Colin, don't stay seated. Come forward with the team and kneel down on one knee. And this was a friend who'd been in the military. Take a knee, it's called. And so Colin began doing the take a knee thing. And since that comment, I noticed there's a car in our neighborhood on the back window. They have an emblem of a soldier on one knee with a rifle, the bayonet stuck in the ground. There's a helmet on the butt of the rifle, and there's a cross there, apparently a gravesite. And you remember last week or 10 days ago when we had the USS McCain got rammed by a oil tanker?
Yes.
Quite a shock, and we lost some sailors in that. Rear Admiral William Burns had his sailors take a knee in honor of the fellow sailors that were lost in that tragic event. And so the idea of taking a knee, it's almost as though it has many meanings. And I think in the case of Colin Kaepernick and then some other members of another team, it might have been Miami. Anyway, other teams have had members who followed suit. And so we don't really know exactly what it is the various people who take a knee are taking a knee for or trying to honor or draw attention to. But certainly in the case of the National Football League, they have an interest in their brand, just like any commercial enterprise does. How does the public see the NFL? And so in this case, some members of the NFL administration are a little bit worried about the way the public views players who take a knee during the Star-Spangled Banner. And so probably we're going to see things worked into the contracts, which is perfectly legal. They won't allow you to smoke on the sidelines, which a few years ago, when I was a kid in high school, I remember pro football, there were guys who smoked on the sidelines. Players mm-hmm. would light up, especially, you know, the kickers who don't play a whole lot. They're sitting there drinking coffee and having a lucky strike, whatever. So the NFL put a stop to that. because they didn't like what it was doing to their image. They probably did care some about the player's health also, but they didn't like what it was doing to the brand. So in this case, with Colin Kaepernick, he's up against the NFL and President Trump and a lot of other dignitaries who are coming down pretty harshly on he and fellow teammates who are doing this. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see something in a contract from various NFL teams about, if you don't want to stand for the national anthem, stay in the locker room, or something like that. Don't draw attention to yourself.
You know, it is so interesting because a lot of the players in the NFL are indeed black. And I would think that most of the owners of teams are indeed white. And I think Colin Kaepernick initially, in terms of Black Lives Matter, every week you were seeing an unarmed black person being shot by a mm-hmm. police officer, mm-hmm. and then the police officer not going to trial. It would be somehow, I don't know how to explain it, to be excused that his life really was in danger, even if the person was walking away or running away. Or
mm-hmm, right.
it was really an amazing thing. And so I admire Kaepernick for taking a stand on that. And mm-hmm. there were other players that were supporting him or taking a knee in solidarity with him. So, I mean, I guess I can understand exactly what you're saying, that the NFL wants this certain image. But at the same time, what a wonderful platform for a sport that has so many African Americans and so much money is made on this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That Kaepernick... Mm-hmm. Good for him.
Mm-hmm. And if you if you consider the NFL's their image, they do continue to employ and teams hire and place and play players who've had terrible domestic violence incidents where they've been arrested, they've done time. They had Michael Vick, who was running a dog fighting. Can you imagine a dog fighting, arena?
Right.
He was found guilty. He went to prison. He came back, and he's playing. Mm-hmm. So there are some lines here that the wife beating doesn't take place on the field. Of course, that's something
right.
in your private life.
Right.
And so there are things about your private life, I guess, that are probably going to work their way into the contract that you have with the team that's a member of the NFL. There might even be things in there now if you engage in egregious acts that are afoul of certain laws and all of that. So anyway, it'll be something to watch.
And it is interesting about Michael Vick as well, because I followed that pretty closely, and I have this magazine that showed some of the surviving dogs. Not that I want to talk about, dog abuse right now, but while he was in prison, and sometimes I ask the students this, he came to a place where he said he realized how wrong that was. He'd grown up with this notion of dog fight, not with the notion of dog fighting, but some of his relatives were engaged in dog fighting.
Yeah.
And so he just kind of pursued that, I guess, through some cousins or whatever. But I think it was, in fact, I think it was the Haven Humane Society. It was one of the animal sanctuary places that the CEO mm-hmm. contacted him. And so he, after he got out of prison, he went to schools to talk about animal abuse. And
okay.
so I commend him for that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, as I understand it, when he first came back on the field, the fans of the NFL booed him tremendously,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I missed that. Right.
So it is very interesting, mm-hmm. the image, that whole point, what you're talking about is, what is the image of the NFL? What mm-hmm. kind of image do they want to perpetuate? And yeah. you have Kaepernick on a knee and being respectful. He mm-hmm. was being respectful mm-hmm. during the,
sure.
the national anthem.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, over the last, it's probably been 10 days or 2 weeks, I've gotten several copies, four, five, six copies of a letter dealing with this issue of taking a knee during the national anthem at an NFL game. And it comes from a fellow who says that he is a retired colonel. I won't mention his name. We'll just call him Jeff. That's his first name. In fact, some of the listeners may have gotten this letter also, because it's had, if I've gotten four, five, six copies of it, probably other people have seen it also. But he describes his service to the nation when he was active duty, that he served in Desert Storm, that is Persian Gulf War number one, and that he had members under his command, maybe in his squad, whatever, who lost their lives in that war. And then he went on to suggest that the players who were taking a knee and not standing for the national anthem are insulting the fellows who died from his squadron or wherever. But I was thinking, you know, I'm sure that he and his soldiers, would say, yes, we support the First Amendment. Yes, freedom of speech. It's just something that's. It's why we fight. It's one of the reasons why we think we're defending the country, although it'd be an odd argument to figure out how Gulf War I or II was defending the country. But they get trained in what they're up to, and they have mental justifications for what they're doing. But the whole idea of going off to war to defend the country so that we can maintain our Constitution with the Bill of Rights and all of the 26 or 27 amendments now, but then not to allow people to express themselves. And so it seemed kind of contradictory. On the one hand, you're going to go off to battle and you lose 14 of your own men in defense of the First Amendment, essentially, in the Constitution. It's just that don't try to practice it unless you run it by me, a retired colonel, and I'll let you know if that's appropriate or not. It was almost that demanding.
And you know what I find offensive, and it's not Kaepernick taking a knee, and I didn't know that was the phrase. That's interesting, taking a knee. It is the U.S.'s involvement with illegal wars and making billions upon billions of dollars for weapons manufacturers and then not telling the public the truth. For example, in Iraq, no weapons of mass destruction, no ties to al-Qaeda. And if you were paying attention if you were paying attention at that time and listened to the weapons inspectors, they told the administration just this very thing, but a war was wanted. Now, that is what I find totally insulting, offensive, and tragic. Mm. It's not Kaepernick.
Yeah, that really is the reasons why we go to war. Sometimes, in fact, Persian Gulf War I was a war that President Bush Sr., when it was over, there were 42 days of bombing, and after the end of the 42 days, the 6 weeks of bombing, 88,000 tons of bombs dropped on Basra and Baghdad. Then we went into a hundred hour ground war, which is probably the shortest ground war in the history of the United States, if not the shortest. And so you have a war there with all kinds of implications for illegal bombing of heavily residential areas in Baghdad and Basra. Maybe as many as 200,000 civilians may have been killed. The estimates vary from 100,000 to 400,000, but at any rate, and at the end of that war, with all the death and destruction, President Bush Sr. Exclaims that finally the American people are over the Vietnam syndrome. They're ready for war again. That's from the President of the United States. Because that whole period of time from 1975 to 1991, the period of time my kids were growing up, went to college and graduated and all that, we weren't involved in a war. The kids who were born in the late 60s made it through until they were probably in college or out of college before we ended up in another series of wars now with some really dubious justifications. So at any rate, that the thing about the colonel who wrote that letter demanding that the NFL punish these players, I'm sure that, he would probably agree that his training has him obey authority, don't question. And that's fine if that's the military orientation. I suppose in a war you need to have somebody who needs to be in charge. But to be a really good citizen, you have to do just the opposite. You have to question everything. Anything the government does, corporations, labor unions, you have to question. You don't accept authority.
Well, isn't it kind of interesting, too, that there's this hypocritical aspect to this? Because when the Nazis were tried at Nuremberg, they were saying they were just following orders. And the court system was saying, well, you should have known. I mean, look at your conscience that, killing all of these people. Well, we were just following orders. So this particular, what Colonel is saying, well, you just should obey, obey, obey. Right. Well, that's not... That when that works for us, that's what we say. But mm-hmm. when we look mm-hmm. at the other side, that's not always the reasonable response, according to.
Well, you've probably heard that phrase, the history is written by the winners.
Yes.
Okay. Well, in the case of the Nuremberg trials, too, if you remember how that was conducted, no allegations of wrongdoing by the Allied powers, that's France, England, the United States, Russia. Nothing that they may have done that would get close to being a war, an act of war criminality, was allowed to be mentioned, including the bombing of Dresden, which most of the people who were aware of what happened at that time realized it was just killing civilians. That's all that happened.
Yes.
In fact,
yes.
A really great historian, Zinn, Howard Zinn,
yes.
The People's History,
yes.
Yeah,
okay,
great book. In fact, Matt Damon, well, anyway... Matt Damon, that's a side story. But Howard Zinn was in WW2 when he was a bombardier flying over Europe. And the war was coming to an end. Everybody in the Air Force, at least in his branch, was aware. It was just a matter of weeks. But they got this new weapon. It was called jellied gasoline. Today it's called napalm. And they'd never used it before. And so they picked out a French village which was thought to have had German soldiers stripped of their uniforms hiding from the Allied forces until the war was over. And so they picked that town to try the napalm out on. And Howard, by his own admissions, he never got over it. Never, ever got over
what
it.
What a terrible thing. What a terrible thing.
Yeah.
If I don't know, if the public could really see in their mind's eye as well as on the news what these horrific weapons can do. And as I understand it, I mean, I don't know how whether you want to continue with this particular line of conversation here, but it's in terms of the white phosphorus, which I thought was illegal internationally, depending on how it's used. And mm-hmm. and that stuff, like napalm, sticks to the skin and just burns and burns and burns. And so the U.S. is being accused off and on about using the white phosphorus. Mm-hmm, on, mm-hmm. And it's just... The weaponry, I mean, it's horrific. It's totally horrific what happens in wars.
Yeah. And there's used uranium, which is radioactive.
Right, the depleted uranium, yes.
Yeah. Well, there is, if you, let's see. I guess the way to look at this photograph that comes out of our Gulf War experience, and
yes.
I'm not sure, Barry McGaffrey is the general who was involved in this incident, but the ceasefire occurred, and 2 days later, General McCaffrey's troops intersected perpendicularly the troops from the Iraqi troops that were leaving Kuwait and headed back toward Baghdad.
Yes, yes.
And they were intercepted 2 days after the ceasefire, and the road then became the Alley of Death or
yes.
Blood Alley and that sort
yes.
of thing. There were pilots coming back refusing to drop their bombs on the soldiers who were, you know, going back home. There was a fellow, I can't remember his name now, but he took a photograph of an Iraqi soldier who was trying to crawl out of his burning, like a Humvee, a big truck. He was trying to crawl out through the windshield and he couldn't, the flames engulfed him. And this fellow got a picture of that scene. And if you have a really strong stomach, you can catch it on the internet if you Google in the war photo that was never published. But make sure that you're ready for something. It's word to the wise anyway. So yeah, that war, the Persian Gulf War, it was very sanitary. We got, the military was not gonna have another Vietnam.
No.
Where we're sitting home eating spaghetti and tossed salad and having French bread, watching monks burn themselves to death in the middle of the streets of Saigon.
Right.
Or a young girl running down the street.
I see that in my mind's eye.
Yeah.
That's right.
Not going to happen.
No. And that was another, I think, important point in terms of we have corporate media. Well, right now, for example, what we're on is community radio. And so we're able to, because we don't have corporate sponsors, have any particular shows that we want. And I might as well tell the listening audience right now, this is KKRN.org, community radio, and this is Dig This Trump Watch with Professor Parker Pollack. And in Vietnam, you're right. I mean, the media showed what was happening. And so what you have in the Iraq wars is this embedded media, meaning, in my opinion, in bed with the military. So you're only getting what is being allowed through corporate media to be shown. And so people, I don't know, I guess they're just not... seeing what all this destruction and suffering and tragedy is about these days.
Well, there was a student, this was probably about, this was after the start of Persian Gulf War II, when President Bush Jr. Invaded the country. This was, that was in March of 03. So this was probably into 04. A student came by after class and said, you know, I was talking to my parents, they were somewhere in Europe, on business or vacation, whatever, and she said, they asked me whether I saw the terrible photographs of what the consequences of our bombing in Iraq, and she said, no, I saw the evening news over a news network that we would all know, not Fox, but she said, yes, I saw it on the same network that you saw it on, but I didn't see the same pictures you saw. So that network was, my conclusion is, the network fed one thing into that young lady's television set and something else into the parents or the people who live in Germany and France. And so we get this sanitized, protected view. And I'm just wondering whether, the people in the media are professional journalists. And so censorship is one of the things that, they're supposed to be schooled to shudder at the thought of censorship, but maybe it's a question of what you have to do to keep your job.
Well, as an example of that, right now with Hurricane Harvey, you don't hear any mention of climate change being one of the factors that has created this intense storm. So we have independent quote unquote journalists, but they are not talking about that. So corporate media, their agenda dictates what the journalist or what the reporter is going to report. And so that's pretty clear, it seems to me, unfortunately.
Well, there's Chomsky.
I do.
And his buddy Herman. Years and years ago, they came out with a book called Manufactured Consent.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Classic.
Yes.
And I'd recommend it to people yet.
Yes.
Sure. It's well worth. It's a good introduction to what we've just been talking about here. Yeah. So at any rate, then Colonel, the Colonel who had written this letter to the NFL, I'm curious about whether or not he lost 14 of his men, and that's there's nothing worse. He describes putting them in body bags. He got out of the service, he finished his term. He was in Persian Gulf War I, that was in the spring of 91. So by 2004, he was the CEO of a company in Southern California who, watch this, makes body bags. And he has this, if you ever get a chance to see him on the internet, just type in the Colonel takes on the NFL. And that'll get you the flyer that I've been getting every 2-3 days in over the internet, over my emails. And he has, you'll get a sense of rage at what these players are doing to the image of his dead soldiers that he put in body bags, and whether or not he's complicit in the fact that he may not have done exactly the right thing. You can always do better, but he didn't do well enough, and he got 14 of his guys killed. I think that may be producing the rage, and I hope he can get some psych help, because right now, he's the only victim of his rage.
It's pretty incredible, and that he also works for a body bag company. Yeah. Maybe he knows something about this is going to be big business.
Oh well, yeah, it could be. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about that. It's been chewing on me ever since I've been getting the letters written by the Colonel, waiting for something maybe to come from the NFL. I doubt that they'll say anything publicly about it. It might just be something they'll talk about privately amongst the owners, but it's one of those things. Again, the Colonel makes it sound like nobody in the NFL ever goes to war. these guys are just raised, they're all just coddled, and they end up with these multi-million dollar salaries. They've never defended the country. And he couldn't possibly have checked out that claim. I checked it out, and there's a list of the guys in the NFL who've been in war. And who could forget the Arizona Cardinals? Pat Tillman, multi-million dollar contract, went off to Afghanistan, got himself killed.
I want to talk about Pat Tillman, and he was a Ranger, and I had a Ranger in one of my classes, not in the same squadron as or unit that Pat Tillman was in, and he was this Ranger in my class said the Rangers were a little bit upset because of all the focus on Pat Tillman because he was this highly paid professional football player. He had his face, he was a good looking guy, square jaw. I think it was on either Time or Newsweek, a magazine like that. But the irony of this is that when he was over there, he realized, he came to some conclusions that, well, maybe we're not doing the right thing here. And he started reading, you know, Zen and so forth. And then what happens to Pat Tillman? He's killed by friendly fire. And he's standing there going, wait, I'm Pat Tillman, Pat Tillman. And they shoot him. And I get very excited about this. And his parents are told that he's killed by the enemy. It takes months and months and months of research and digging on their part, especially the mother, to find out what happened to her son.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't even tell the truth about what happened to Pat Tillman.
Well, you may have talked to students too at the time, students who knew quite a bit about that, who suggested that it was on purpose.
Yeah.
There was nothing friendly about it, that they were going to get rid of this fellow.
Right.
I haven't been able to find any corroboration for that, but
but the whole notion, the term friendly fire, and especially, I mean, they have one of the documentaries I was watching was that people had said he was saying, I'm Pat Tillman, but that didn't stop the bullets.
Mm-hmm,
so anyway,
yeah,
it's just so he's a dead Tillman, and his brother, who was also a Ranger,
Kevin,
I guess, picked up this kind of. Trying to investigate more about what is happening with his brother.
Right.
So it's
his parents got a nice letter from, I guess, the president and a flag. And then his brother stepped forward and said, wait a minute, because the letter was very, congratulatory about your son defending the country with his life and giving the last final effort there. And Kevin came forward and said, no, wait, folks, to his mom and dad, that's a lie. I was in the same area when Pat got killed, and it wasn't enemy fire. So,
yes,
that family really went through hell
trying
to get past that.
And see, this is another example of, I just wish people would tell the truth. The government would tell the truth. The military would tell the truth. But if they did, we wouldn't be in endless war situations with a bunch of corporations making a ton of money.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
It's just... it's pretty awful.
Yeah. Well, the case of Pat Tillman reminds me of an incident that occurred. Well, we'll talk about Andrew Bacevich later in our, maybe not this program, but another one, because Bacevich is a big name in one of our future topics. Anyway, so.
Well, Professor Pollack, I think maybe we should take just a little break now, and then we'll come right back. And so, once again, this is KKRN.org.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we. As we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years. When we will have about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere, will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We use so much and waste so much. How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense, it contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend.
Hello, we're back with Dig This, Trump Watch, with Professor Parker Pollack, and we have been talking about, well, various things, from war to images in the NFL, and I'm sure that Professor Pollack has much more that he would like to discuss today. So what would you like to say now, Professor Pollack?
Well, we'll probably come back to the Colonel's rage, although I do hope he gets over it, about people taking a knee. And the NFL will, I'm certainly, maybe, you know, behind closed doors, they'll try to work out something that is more suitable to their brand that they'd like to convey to the public. We could come back to it, I guess,
okay,
in another program. But I'd like to move on to President Trump's, it seems like he's really anxious about everything Russian. And there's been so much written, not just about the chief investigator or the special investigator Mueller, but gee, if you look at the following magazines: National Review, The Weekly Standard, The Progressive, Mother Jones, The Nation, Z Magazine, Time Magazine. They're all covering President Trump's campaign staff and occasionally President Trump's relationships, his personal relationship with Putin, of course, I guess is fairly well known, but the relationships between the campaign staff and people in and out of Russian government, political and economic circles, it's just, there's an issue let's see, which one is this? Well, this one is Mother Jones from July, August of 2017. It's just there's pictures here of everybody who is possibly being investigated by Mueller, and it's quite an array of people from various walks of life, and they cover in some depth President Trump's son Don Jr. And his meeting with the attorney, the lady who was not probably part of Putin's staff and. Maybe she was doing something on her own. Initially, President Trump and or his son, no, the son, said that they talked about, what's it called? Adoptions.
Yes.
They talked about adoptions, which certainly could have, very plausible, given what we know about the Magnitsky Law, which was passed in this country about 10 years ago, when we had a fellow, an American, along with his Russian guide and interpreter and cohort, they were doing investments in Russia, and they came across some really scandalous things going on, corrupt things going on in Moscow, by Russians. And so Magnitsky, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, he, as a Russian, he made it known to the authorities that this corruption was going on. And in short order, he was found dead. And so the fellow who was his partner, the American, Browder, he was just livid, came to this country, spread the word about what had happened to his buddy, his partner, and so got a bill passed that any time there's some flagrant abuses of personal rights that can be conveyed, I guess, and given some fair hearing, that if that happens, the people involved will have sanctions put against them. And as Russian citizens, they won't be allowed to travel with the United States. Their bank assets here will be frozen. None of their family will be able to travel to the United States. And so that law is still on the books. It hasn't been repealed. So in retaliation, Putin went ahead and then canceled any possibility for Americans to adopt disabled Russian children. And that's that ban is still in effect as well. And so Don Jr. may well have been talking to this lady about the adoption process, and she telling him probably, look, if you can figure out how to get that act repealed, I can get President Putin to end the ban against the adoptions. Well, that they moved on by his own admissions. They moved on to other topics. But that idea, it gives you some idea of how the Russian government system works and why it was so difficult for Trump and some of his other fellow investors to feel their way into the Russian economy and make investments. I guess it's well known now, in early 2016, Trump was beginning to negotiate for a tower, Trump Tower Hotel in Moscow. Apparently it fell through, didn't happen. But trying to get some feel for how the Russians work, it's entirely possible that this lady that met with Don Jr. was doing this just as a way to get some leverage with Putin by saying, look, I met with the president's, or soon-to-be president's son. We talked about several things. I now have information that I can use with him, for him, against him, whatever. And so that's something that in the name that's commonly used now among about two or three people for the Russian political system is that it's an adhocracy, as in ad hoc.
Yes.
Single item politics. You just come up with something from the grassroots level, like this lady trying to work out a deal with Don Jr. about adoptions or some other things they might have been talking about. Who knows? Although Mueller is certainly chasing that down as well. And so you have an adhocracy with the possibility of it being so vague that it's ambiguous. Her relationship with Putin, that's just known to her and Putin. And Putin's decisions, since he's fairly autocratic, it may never be known how much influence she has or doesn't have. And so from Putin's point of view, he can deny anything about hacking into the election because that could have been an ad hoc piece of behavior by some technocrat, some really smart technical person in Russia, and that he had nothing to do with, maybe, maybe not. I have a hunch he has something to do with everything, but it's plausible deniability. So I'm beginning to use this phrase that Russia is an adhocracy with ambiguity and plausible deniability. So we'll probably come back to that as the affair moves along with Mueller.
Well, you know, Professor Pollack, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking, and I'm wondering how much, and we don't have an answer to this, I know, how much of this focus on Russia is a distraction from the neo-Nazis, our healthcare system, our environmental degradation, I mean, to say the least, climate change deniers, endless wars, our support of Saudi Arabia's intervention, well, war on the Yemenis people that have hundreds of thousands of cases of cholera now that are just suffering. So all these really significant things are happening, and the media really does continue that hype of Russia. So I'm kind of left. I mean, what do you think? I'm kind of left in this this position of, you know, what is really going on here?
Yeah. There's several things that, as you know, since January 20th, when Donald Trump was inaugurated, It's as though the last 7 months we've gone from one dumpster fire to another.
Meanwhile,
as you mentioned, all these other things are happening, and I just was looking at a copy of, well, the current edition of Z Magazine. This would be the September 17 issue of Z Magazine, in which they, on page 7, they mention, the appointees of Trump are working full-time to overturn protections of air and water pollution, consumer protections, bank and financial regulations, and other rules that protect Americans from corporate misdeeds. While the public sorts through stupid presidential Twitter posts, misnaming China's leader as being the leader of Taiwan, et cetera, et cetera. So there was an article in the Record Searchlight about 2 weeks ago that dealt with the states now are faced with filing lawsuits to stop that kind of degradation that's going on by the agency heads that President Trump has appointed, who are, regardless of the dumpster fires that get all the attention, there's some real degradation going on amongst the services for people and for well, Mother Nature and the environment and regulations for banking, et cetera.
I mean, the head of the EPA who filed lawsuit after lawsuit against the EPA until he was appointed head of the EPA, or the Department of Interior, who was an oil man. I mean, it just goes on and on. And I mean, these are really significant things. I mean, in terms of toxic cleanups, in terms of water quality, in terms of the air we breathe. And I was mentioning earlier with the terrible, terrible disaster in Houston, and no mention of climate change by corporate media. And then this factory off just out of Houston a little ways, I don't know whether it's a chemical plant.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's releasing these terrible toxic plumes, and they will not give the information of what is exactly in there. They give a list of ingredients, but they will not say in what proportions, how they were kept, where they're located. And the company's response is, well, because we don't want to give terrorists this information. So the surveillance on the American people, well, that's because of terrorism. You can't know this because that's because of terrorism. I mean, how convenient is that? We're going to continue this war because we're going to stop terrorism, when in fact, we seem to be creating more hate, more animosity, more suffering. I mean, if my whole family was killed in some sort of airstrike, that's not going to win my heart and mind. That's going to just make me vengeful.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's bizarre. It's like some sort of reality show. Maybe that's what it is, Professor Pollack.
Well, there's a Marilyn, I can't remember her last name, but she wrote a book called What Was Asked of Us. And it's also available in a video. She interviews some of the soldiers from the Iraq War and one from the Vietnam War. And the one fellow from the Iraq War describes a situation there on the outskirts of Baghdad where they had to put up a roadblock real quick. And so it wasn't very, as he put it, wasn't very, very buffed up. And so an Iraqi father with a young boy in the back seat came around the corner and saw the roadblock and didn't get stopped in time and slammed on the brakes. And so the soldiers rushed up to the car, couldn't get the door open, the driver's door open. It was jammed. And so this fellow, Rappenhouse, I think might be his name, he said, I just reached through the window and grabbed the father by the shirt and dragged him out through the window and then roughed him up as I was putting some handcuffs or those nylon things on, and he said, and then he looked. He said, "I looked up into the rear window, and there was about a 10 or 12 year old boy looking at me, abusing his father." And I'm wondering, boy, he's probably thinking, "I can't wait till I get my hands on an AK-47." And so, if we think our presence is winning the hearts and minds, hopefully we can get to it at another time too, but. But the we're going to step right into it again with Afghanistan. I'm not sure. Well, maybe we could move to the Afghan policy that he came up with. What was it, a week ago or so? But we probably should at least mention Bannon leaving.
Right ahead.
Yeah, I was really waiting for. Well, I guess a lot of people were waiting for since all those staff changes were taking place since we had the last program. you wouldn't know the cars in the parking lot anymore at the White House. But you've got a new guy in there. Well, the thing that struck me about all those changes was that you have a chief of staff who gets fired by the new communications director, and then there's another person who's brought in, a retired general who's brought in, and he fires the communication director. And then someone else gets laid off too in the process. But eventually, this worked around to Steve Bannon, the chief advisor, retiring and going back to Breit, his radio program. But he was, as far as I could tell, Bannon was one of those advisors to Trump who would suggest it's time to pull back from the rest of the world. Pull back, mm-hmm. pull back. Mm-hmm. And as well as shrink the government, shrink mm-hmm. the government. And so there are other people. McMaster now is the National Security Advisor replacing Flynn. I wish I could remember the White House Chief of Staff, Kelly. And retired military also like McMaster, and then the communications director. So Bannon's exit means that there isn't probably that major voice whispering in President Trump's ear, pull back, pull back.
And I thought it was ironic that right before he was fired or let go or laid off, however it was described, he said there is no military solution in terms of North Korea.
Yeah.
And I thought, that is amazing that Bannon would say that.
Mm-hmm.
And boom, he's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't that? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was surprised he said it too.
Yeah.
Someone else had said it who wasn't in the inner circle. Rats. I can't remember the man or woman's name, but they whoever said it, I remember thinking, well, now that person seems knowledgeable, mm-hmm. and they're coming around to the idea that that war is not a solution here.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, you're going to have to come to diplomacy.
Yeah. Oh, why bother with diplomacy when we have all these weapons? You can just kill them all.
Well, do you remember a Secretary of State we had back in the 90s, Madeleine Albright?
Yes.
Somebody asked her one time about the use of nuclear weapons, and she said, well, what's the point of having them if we don't use them? I couldn't believe my ears.
Wasn't she also the one when it was asked about all the children, the Iraqi children, I mean, hundreds of thousands that had died from sanctions and from war, mm-hmm. that, what was it worth was it? And what did she say?
She said yes. Yeah. Right. I remember that too. Yeah.
And this is the irony. It's more than irony. On one hand, we're saying we want the people to be democratic. We want to free them. We want them to be able to live their lives without torture, without, you know, in peace. But in the process of what, quote, liberating these people, we kill half of them.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
that just doesn't seem right.
Yeah. Well, you remember the phrase came out of Vietnam, that war, where there was a village that we saved. But in order to save it, we had to destroy it. I can't remember the name of the city. It might have been Hue Way.
In order to save it, we had to destroy it.
Yeah,
oh, that
yeah.
is so.
Right.
I mean, don't people see the what of that? The
mm-hmm,
the
mm-hmm.
absurdity.
Yeah. Right. What's the point? Jeez. So at any rate, I think as Bannon leaves and we're moving into a surge into Afghanistan, the voice in Trump's ear won't be saying pull back, pull back. But if you take a look at what happened to President Trump when he sat down with those military people, they got him. It reminded me so much of when Obama sat down with those people from the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the American Medical Association.
To come up with
Obamacare. It was like he was a lamb, and they invited him over for dinner. Same thing happened to Trump. They got him in the room, and they let him know how the world turns, and he bought it all. And so now not only are we going to stay in Afghanistan, we're going to double down. We're going to put in another maybe 4,000 troops, but in some new strategy. So not to worry. It's a new strategy.
A new strategy. And as I understand it, every leader that is put into power in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya or a coalition government, That's not what the people want. It is amazing. It's not what the people want. And what was the main reason for going into Syria? Because we didn't like Assad? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is Assad's country. It's a sovereign nation. Well, not anymore.
No, it hardly exists. Yeah.
And these countries that some of them, like Iraq, were basically first world countries. You had men and women working together. Mm-hmm. You had a good, healthy infrastructure. I mean, not that everything was, you know, okay within the system, but now they're living in bombed out, war torn, not having power, sewage problems. I mean, it's terrible. We've destroyed huge parts of countries.
Yeah. That's... What we did with Iraq is I don't know. I can't imagine how we've gotten around it emotionally as a country. There's been so much out about what we did there, and the havoc that we unleashed made a haven for other kinds of terrorists to take place. It makes me wonder how President Bush Jr. sleeps at night.
And this was predicted. This just didn't happen. I mean, it was predicted. If you go in there and you topple this particular regime and you do these things, it's going to create this vacuum. There's going to be a problem. You're going to have terrorists coming in. You're going to create terrorists. Mm-hmm. Yep, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Professor Pollack, we only have 9 minutes left. Can you believe it?
Wow. maybe what we could do is hold over the Afghan thing until the next program.
Okay.
And see if we could go through some of the notable events that have happened in past June, July, and August. And I think in doing, you know what's happened to me since I started making this list of the notable events of past Junes or July or whatever the month happened to be?
Yes.
I'm starting to come to this hunch that we may have found the answer to when was America great.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm not ready to put this in ink yet, but the publishers are all lined up waiting, I'm sure. No, but I think it pops out at me from time to time.
Well, then you should share this.
Okay, well.
But what you can. What yeah. Share what you can.
Yeah, I'm under contract here. If we go through like June, notable events from past Junes, 1863, Harriet Tubman frees 750 slaves. 1877, the Molly Maguires are hanged in Pennsylvania, organizing a union. They were a strict Irish secret society, the largest execution in U.S. history. 1954, the CIA invades Guatemala, overthrows Arbenz, a democratically elected guy. 1962, Port Huron Statement from the Students for Democratic Society, Tom Hayden. There may be listeners out there that remember Tom from the old days from the University of Wisconsin. 1964 also, three civil rights workers killed in Mississippi, Goodman, Shorter, and Cheney. Who can ever forget those names? They found him buried in a dam later. They released him after they arrested him for taillight violation. They released him at 2 a.m. with a crowd waiting for him. And
it's so interesting because there was an interview with an elderly woman since that time about what happened because she lived in that area. And she goes, well, we were told they were communists.
Oh, jeez.
So that means it's okay to kill them,
sir,
right?
Yeah.
Right, right.
They have no rights.
we'll bury them under concrete.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to register people to vote.
That's
because
they
wanted equality. So that's equated with communism. Give me a break. Mm-hmm. But
okay.
Go ahead.
Also, 1965... Supreme Court decision, watch this, Griswold versus Connecticut, the Supreme Court states that the ban on the use of contraceptives is illegal. There was a ban on the use of contraceptives in some states, and so it was deemed to be illegal. That's 1965. 1966, the Miranda decision, you have a right to remain silent, blah, blah, blah. 1967, the Supreme Court legalizes interracial marriage. That's in our lifetime. That's 1967. Let's see, 1969, Stonewall Rebellion against a police raid in Greenwich Village against gay and LGBT, a bar there. 1971, the Pentagon Papers are published by Daniel
Ellsberg.
Thank you. And 1971, that was, the Pentagon Papers. And then No, 2013. Ed Snowden, National Security Administration, spying, CIA contractor, copied and leaked all that information out of the National Security Administration folders. Then in past July's, 1835, children strike for an 11-hour day in 20 textile mills in Paterson, New Jersey. The day was 14 hours. 2,000 went on strike, mostly Irish little kids. That's 1835. 1848, the Seneca Women's Rights Convention, a big deal at that point. 1877, the Great Railroad Strike begins. The fourth year of the 73 panic. We used to have panics in this country.
Panics.
People would run to the bank and get all their money out. Everything would slow down. but as I look down through the list here, like for July, I won't give you the years, but here's Strikers Battle. 20 railroad employees are killed. Lumberjack strike for an 8-hour day. John Scopes is convicted for teaching evolution. Can I say that on the radio?
I think so. Community radio.
Community radio. The National Labor Relations Act is passed. That's 1935. That gives workers the right to have a union and go on strike nonviolently. Yeah, up to that point, they were illegal. The Stockyard Riots in Chicago, the first A-bomb explosions in New Mexico were in 1945, and then the big ones, of course, in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Cesar Chavez, 1970, United Farm Workers and the Great Boycott. The ADA is signed, 1990, Bush Sr., Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yes, yes.
2015, the Confederate flag is removed from the South Carolina State Capitol. Have you thought much about the arguments for keeping statues of Civil War heroes that were in the Confederacy?
I have thought about that, and maybe we should do a segment on that in the future, because seems to me a lot of information, I mean, that we could consider when we think about that. And they weren't put up necessarily right after the Civil War, you know? And in fact, I would like to talk about that at a later time.
Do that. Yeah,
and
right.
it was the grandson of one of the Confederate generals that
Robert E. Lee.
Was it? I don't know. It was somebody else that was being interviewed and said it was Jackson. That said
Stonewall Jackson.
That we should. The grandson said definitely this statue should come down. You know.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
so.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That. He had blood on his hands there, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
it's been a hot topic issue there. But as I went through those items from June and July, the thing that struck me, and then when we did the ones from April and May, is that maybe that we were great when the people stood up took a knee.
There you go.
When the people go against the grain. The historians call it populism. But yeah, when they stand in the way of corporations or oppressive governments, state, local, federal, whatever.
And when you were talking about that, I was thinking about capitalism and how predatory capitalism can just run over the people. And these people, I mean, 11-year-old children, children who were wanting an 11-hour day, or Cesar Chavez, the terrible working conditions that they had in the fields, or other union workers that gave their lives, that were killed, just to have some sort of fairness. For the workers, in the face of relentless capitalism, unbridled capitalism, about the money, and I'm going to make as much as I can, and I don't care, if you're in the way or the environment is in the way.
That is really covered well by Howard Zinn in that big book,
The People's History,
because he spends a good deal of time on working men and women. Yeah,
we have a minute and a half left.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I could just maybe mention. Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of America, the United States. Matt Damon mentioned it in the movie Good Will Hunting. He was a very smart math, came easy to him, but he was a custodian, actually, in a name university in the East Coast. And he ended up in a psychologist's office, Robin Williams. He looked at all of Robin's books and he said, the one you're missing here is you ought to read Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States. I wondered at the time during the movie whether Howard got a kick out of that when it happened.
Well, Professor Pollack, I want to thank you so much for your hosting today and all the good information that and educational information that you're giving our audience. And I want to thank the listeners. And I want to remind the listeners that this is KKRN.org, Community Radio, Round Mountain, Bella Vista, and we are listener-supported. And please tune in next Saturday for Pearl on Politics with Professor David Pearl, who will be discussing labor and union issues with guest John Whitmer. So this is just kind of a follow-up for the union aspects that you introduced today, Professor Pollack.
Super. Maybe we can ride on their tails, too.
That's right, by golly. Okay. Thank you, and bye-bye.